Today we have a special two-hour broadcast on WTXC that we're so excited about because tomorrow is the 13th annual Hudson Children's Book Festival. And we're really lucky to have a bunch of authors and illustrators on the radio today. We're going to talk with our first group for about an hour, and then we're going to switch to another group. The first group is folks that primarily write for middle grade and young adult audiences, and then we'll have a group that primarily writes for picture book younger readers. But before we dive into introductions with all our fabulous authors, I just want to give some information about the book festival. For those that are listening, hopefully everybody has already heard about it and is planning to go. But tomorrow, Saturday, May 4th, from 10 to 3 at the Hudson Junior Senior High School, there will be an amazing festival. It's the 13th annual festival here in Hudson with, I forget how many, I don't know if anyone knows the number this year, but 100-ish, maybe 80, I don't know. I'm bad at estimating. But a lot of authors and illustrators who write for young audiences. It's such a great lineup. You can check out HudsonChildrensBookFestival.com to see everybody who's coming, and you can see a map of where everyone is so you can scope out your favorites. And there's also an exhibitors hall with community organizations such as the library. So you can come visit different community groups, see what's going on for the summer. But obviously the highlight is the authors and illustrators, and we're so excited to have them all here today. So I think we'll dive right in and do some introductions here, who we've got in the room with us. Oh, and for those listening, we're in the teen room of the library. Hooray. Yay. So here we can start with Allie over here.
Hi, I'm Allie Trace. I'm the author of Free Period. It's a middle grade story of friendship and period equity that's out now from Scholastic. And by period, I mean blood. I'm talking about menstruation. This is a laugh out loud funny book where a couple of best friends who happen to be chaos monsters fight to get maxi pads in all school bathrooms for all students who menstruate. What they find is that they come to this project because they're actually being punished for a prank that went out of control. And what they find is that the antics that have always gotten them in trouble actually get people feeling more welcome and laughing and breaking down barriers to get them involved in the movement. So what I really hope that kids get out of this experience is that they laugh at the banter. There's wildly weird crafts like crochet uteruses. There's delightfully disgusting desserts like maxi pad cupcakes. And I want them to have a good time and remember that when you want to fight for change, it doesn't have to be fancy or formal, and you don't have to wait till you're a grown up. You can do it right now and have fun using whatever you love to do in life.
Awesome. Sounds good. And for the radio listeners that obviously can't see us, there's a crochet uterus in the teen room right now. Special guest.
Hey, I'm Don P. Hooper. I have a short story in a middle grade anthology called Black Boy Joy, called Got Me a Jetpack. It's about a kid who goes on a space adventure. He's from the hood, and usually I always saw stories when I was a kid where a black teen or a black boy would always get in trouble for doing something. Instead, he goes on an adventure and finds out some wonderful things about his family. And my debut YA novel is True True. It's about another black teen from Brooklyn, second generation Jamaican. He leaves his friends and his neighborhood behind to transfer to a mostly white prep school in Manhattan. He studied martial arts his whole life, and he gets attacked in a racist incident in high school. In the first week he's there, he soon realizes that fists don't help him in this kind of problem that he's facing, because it's not about the bullying that he's facing, it's about the system that allows that bullying to persist. So he reads Sun Tzu and he stages a war against the school's administration. And it's about community building, finding your voice, finding who you are, and seeing how other people see you. You know, there's the world that you define for yourself, the world that the media defines, the world that politicians define, and the world that the adults kind of define. So he's navigating all of that. That's me.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Baker. I'm the author of Forgive Me Not, and I use she, her pronouns, and I'm from Queens, New York, so Don and I are New Yorkers, and Ellen's also in New York, too. And Forgive Me Not is a dual perspective novel. You hear from Violetta and her older brother, Vince, in the first person. It looks at criminal justice, but specifically the ways in which reform are supposed to be better, but are not necessarily better. So in this land, in this world, even though it's very much like the world we live in today, what happens if the victims, or those who are considered the victims of a crime committed by a juvenile person, in this case they're called offenders, which is not the proper word, but is a term used to propagate very, very problematic nature of how criminal justice works. And in this case for Violetta, because she did a DUI driving under the influence, her younger sister dies. And so her family are the ones who decide what happens to her. And they have three choices. Either she can be detained for a certain amount of time in juvenile detention center, she can be set free and they can go on a path to healing, or she can do this thing called the trials, which is a form of reformative justice, which is not really reformative justice. In this, she ends up doing the trials. That's in the first chapter. I'm not spoiling anything. And then you see how the justice system works. You see how a family in great vulnerability makes decisions when they realize they're wrong, but really want to believe in the system at hand. And then you see from Violetta's perspective what it is like to be detained and to kind of figure out what forgiveness looks like, and also what your level of humanity is deserved and how you were treated when you've done something that you can't take back, but which you acknowledge and take ownership for. So the aim is for young people especially to see young people have agency in very extreme situations, to also see communities of love in the midst of a lot of really horrific things, but it's not traumatic in that way. And also come away with a lot of critical thinking about the way our justice system works and the way that reform is used, especially when it comes to people of color.
Hello, my name is Ellen Hagen. I am so thrilled to be here with you all. The Hudson Library also felt like such a welcoming space. Even as I got in here, I was talking about libraries being this hub for young people coming together, people of all ages, just coming together and being able to share what they love about books. So it feels very special to be here with you all. My books include Watch Us Rise, co-written with Renee Watson, who is an incredible friend and also the inspiration of mine. And my other books are novels in verse. So Reckless Glorious Girl, Don't Call Me a Hurricane, and All That Shines are all written in verse. I started out as a poet. I'm originally from Kentucky. So all my books, I feel like, are characters navigating identity, who they are, how they want to show up in the world, as they're figuring out who they are, what their history is, landscape. There's a lot of food in my books. There's a lot of love stories between, romantic love stories, but there's also a lot of love stories between friends and them figuring out how do we collaborate together, how do we community together, and how do we build alongside of each other. In the last book, All That Shines, Chloe Brooks is also dealing specifically with wealth. Our family loses all of their wealth within the first section of the book, so they're figuring out who they are without all the excess and without all the stuff. So hopefully these books also are dealing with the same way that young people are dealing with many things at the same time. Hopefully you'll find a way to navigate all of those emotions and feelings in the books.
Thank you. Oh, that's great. Hi, I'm Alyssa Wishingred, and I am a Hudson Valley author. I live about an hour down the valley from here. I write historical fantasy for middle grade readers. And what that sort of means is I like to take times and places from history that we can recognize and then add fantastical elements. So my first book, The Verdigris Pond, takes place in a kind of medieval time period, and there's an element of magic in it. My more recent book, which just came out in September, Between Monsters and Marvels, takes place at the turn of the 20th century, which was a time of great change across the world. We were transitioning from people really living on farms and moving into the cities to work in these new factories. The world was changing really quickly. This story is about a girl named Dare Coates who's grown up on an island that was once inhabited by monsters. Everybody thinks that the monsters are all gone, but after Dear's beloved father is killed under mysterious circumstances. She is convinced that the monsters are back. And the story is about her trying to find out the truth of what happened to her father and prove that the monsters still exist. But really what I write about, the themes that I write about, are learning to you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
History, to really check the stories that we've been told. What have we been told? How the world has developed? What's the truth of the monsters? Who are the real monsters? Because I really feel like it's vitally important for all of us to really examine the stories that we've been told, the things that we take for granted as absolute truths, and to look through those to find the true complexity of life.
Hi, I'm Melissa Larson. I came into the children's literature area through picture books, so I have several picture books, but I'm here to talk today about my novels. The first novel came out last year. It's called Playing Through the Turnaround. And I think I wrote it because as I've worked with kids over the years, I've realized we do a really bad job of listening to them. Mm-hmm. It's hard to listen because of the structures that are around adulthood. But we don't do a good job, and it damages them, but it damages us. Mm-hmm. And so it's a story of told in 6 points of view about a group of kids whose happy place at school is what they call Jazz Lab. It's an audition-only group. It's small. And their teacher is kind of amazing, gives them freedoms that they haven't had before. And he suddenly stops showing up at school, but no one will tell them why. For some reason, no one will talk to them about it. So it's a little bit of a mystery as they try and figure out what is going on, and as they find out what they think is going on, and as they bring in the rest of the school to try and change the things that are happening inside their school, they start to listen to each other, find out more about each other. So it's about coming together and what can happen when we do listen to each other. My second middle grade novel will come out this September, and it's called Quagmire Tiarello Couldn't Be Better. And it takes a scene-stealing character from this book who wasn't one of the main, you know, Jazz Lab people, was kind of over to the side, and so it's not a sequel, but it tells his story because he was fun. So
I'm Nancy Castaldo, and I am a local author. I live right nearby, and Hudson is one of my local libraries. The book that I have today here is my most recent. It's called The World That Feeds Us, and it's one of about two dozen other books that I have about the planet. So I write mostly nonfiction, and I write mostly about biodiversity in one shape or form, and about activism. So I have books that range from picture book to YA, and most of my books have characters that are wildlife, that are animals, such as moose and wolves and condors and animals like that. And then books like The World That Feeds Us and The Farm That Feeds Us that really stemmed from our local farms here around Hudson. In fact, the farmer's market in Hudson is in one of my books. And those basically center on food security, local farming, and how sustainability is such an important part of our future and what we really need to move forward with our agriculture systems. So my YA books that are also going to be here, my young adult books, include books about the water crisis, When the World Runs Dry, The Story of Seeds, which is a young adult version, basically, of The World That Feeds Us, that talks about sustainability and our food security, and Buildings That Breathe, which talks about urban architecture and how we can green our planet through our cities. So most of these books all talk about, as I said, biodiversity in one shape or form, but also really instill activism and empowerment in my readers, because I want them to know that they can all make a difference, no matter where they live and what they're doing in society and where their interest lies. There's a place for them to make the planet better.
I'm Marina Budos, and I'm actually an author of fiction and nonfiction middle grade YA. I've done two co-authored nonfiction books with my husband, who's a nonfiction children's book and YA author. But I'm really here to talk about my fiction and to be here for that. So a lot of my books are really about either immigrant teenagers and sort of the invisible stories of what they face, or mixed race students, mixed race young people, and some of the, you know, what they have to navigate in the world. So one of the books I'm going to be displaying is The Long Ride, which is a middle grade book. And it's about three mixed race girls in the 1970s when an integration plan is being implemented in Queens, and just sort of the conflict that they have to navigate being in more than one world. And another middle grade book I have is Tell Us We're Home, which is also a kind of three-girl friendship tale, is about three girls who are daughters of maids and nannies in a wealthy suburban town. And so it's kind of how that works. But my most recent novel, which is the one I'm sort of here for, is We Are All We Have. This is part of a trilogy I wrote. It's a post 9/11 trilogy. And it's about a Pakistani girl who is an asylum seeker, or rather her mother is an asylum seeker. And she wakes up, the novel opens, she wakes up and there has been an ICE raid. It's set in 2019. Her mother is taken away. It turns out their case is actually rather fragile. Which she did not know. She thought she was graduating and was going to have a great end of senior year and start college. And she winds up kind of swept into the shelter system, busting out of that and going on a kind of road trip in search of not only her sense of safety and sanctuary, but it turns out there were a lot of layers of family secrets behind this situation that her mother and herself and her little brother are in. There's also a bit of romance in it because she leaves with an undocumented boy, Carlos. And there's also snippets of literary allusions because she wants to be a writer. So there is Whitman. It's her version of On the Road, trying to seize her America, and as well, Ghazal poetry.
Awesome. Thank you all for introducing yourselves. It's more fun hearing from you than just reading a bio. So, we have two of our Bound by Books co-hosts that couldn't make it today, and they sent us some questions that they wanted to ask. So I'm going to start off with one of those. So Fatia was wondering, because Fatia is an author as well, she was wondering where you get your ideas for your stories. Mm-hmm. I know that's possibly a tricky question, but go for it, whoever wants to dive in.
I'll dive in first. I get a lot of my ideas from travel and news stories. And again, my stories are mostly nonfiction. So sometimes stories feed off of each other. I'll be researching one book and finding out a really cool fact of something else and thinking, oh, that may deserve its own book, dip down the research path. So ideas can come from any place, and they often do.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. Fatia, I would say that a lot of my ideas come from playing with the voices of characters, just sort of auditioning characters by trying to listen to what they have to say. Mm-hmm. And when there's one that I think, that's interesting, just writing further into that. Mm. I very rarely, and I feel like it would work much better if I did, but I very rarely know where we're going until we're almost there, and then that means a lot of rewriting, but that's the way it works for me. Or on the picture book side, I will say that sometimes it's just about words and how they fit together. So my latest picture book is called All of Those Babies, and it's about it started because I found out while doing research for a different book that baby echidnas are called puggles. And I was like, what? How did I get to be this age without knowing this? And then started looking up all the baby animal names and thought, there are porcupets? What? And it's very rare that a writer who hangs out with words all the time gets a fresh trove of things they didn't know, and then off to the races.
I think because I write fantasy, a lot of the time for me, my idea, I think an idea for a book comes from several different places, and there's several different things that inspire me. It'll be a character, it'll be a time period that I want to dig deeper into, but also the kind of magic or fantastical element that I want to explore. So with Between Monsters and Marvels, I'm fascinated by why are we still scared of monsters, right? Like, we live in this world, we have all this knowledge at our fingertips. We're not living by candlelight where there's shadows in the dark. So what is it about monsters, and why do we keep creating monsters, and what do we create monsters out of, and what purpose does that serve us as individuals and as a society, and what purpose, how does it do us a great disservice as well? So sort of intellectual ideas.
I think that sometimes because I do nonfiction and fiction, sometimes there are certain nonfiction or things that are going on in the world, say with We Are All We Have, in terms of the crisis at the border and what was happening with asylum at that time, but that's not enough. I mean, that's a news article that, you know, I don't have to write a YA book about it. So I sort of set the stage knowing that I'm thinking about this, and I wait for that character to seize me. And in the case of Rania for this most recent novel, she was literally in my mind sitting on the subway across from me in Brooklyn one day, and I saw her on her way to school. And she was fierce, she was a poet, and I just kind of wanted to know her. So I sort of set a stage of what I'm poking around in and then wait for the characters to kind of enter that stage.
Yeah, I was going to say that there were two things that I always think of myself first as a documentarian. I was somebody who kept a journal. I still do. It was anything of heartbreak or anything that was the aches of growing up and being a teenager. I feel like I'm carrying that always. I'm thinking of that. And I work now at a place called the Dream Yard Project. It's an arts and social justice-based organization that works in schools all predominantly in the Bronx, but all over New York City. And I'm always seeing young people who I want to be in the story. So I'm seeing the activists that they are. In Watch Us Rise, it's about feminism. It's about fighting back against racism and colorism and figuring out how to harness and maintain their voices. And there's in Don't Call Me a Hurricane, it's about a young climate activist. And I can see and pinpoint the young people I'm writing about in the classroom. So I can hear their voices or hear what they're fighting for, and they're not timid. Like the idea of teenagers not knowing how they know what to say, and they remind me of my own struggles as a teenager. And so I'm writing for them and for myself and my children, figuring out what stories do they need and which ones do I still need as an adult.
I love that you say that, Ellen, that who we write for. And I know that's not, we're not there yet to that question, but I love that. And so often I think that we all have that reader in our minds when we're writing, or we see that reader in the faces of somebody. I know I do that too. I love your book, Don't Call Me a Hurricane, because of its climate activism and because those kids. And I could see that when you're saying that, you can see that reader. And I know, like, when I'm writing When the World Runs Dry, for example, my water book, I had the same kind of thoughts. Well, I had the kid who is in Louisiana and is suffering from having their land flooded. And I want to give them tools so that they can reach out and go and help somebody else or help themselves. And I think we all have those readers always come to us, don't they, in so many different ways.
I think for my book, at least for these two stories, it was always like, for Black Boy Joe, I'd recently got attacked by the cops, and I didn't feel like there was any joy in my life. And then I randomly got this text from my friend Danielle Page, and she was just like, submit to Black Boy Joy. And it was like Kwame Mbali put a message out. He was looking for two traditionally unpublished authors who were Black male or non-binary. And it said the story that pain wasn't excluded, but it just had to center on joy. And from my pitches in like to like Disney and Nickelodeon and like things like that, I never gotten that freedom to write in that manner. So I wanted to just, it was like, oh, if this is the only story I get to write, what am I going to put down? Because so often I was like writing these pitches based off of what the networks were asking for, what these people were asking for. And I was just like, okay, I just want a Black person who is of Caribbean descent from Brooklyn, go off on an adventure that I'd never seen when I was a kid. I never had that. Like, you always have this kind of, there was always like white characters who, oh, my parents were a spy and this. And I was like, that was always cool when I saw those characters in cartoons and in books. But I was like, what is that Black character like? And what is that Black character like when their mom is love science? And that was something that was always like prohibited when I was pitching in TV. So I wanted to have like all of that in that book and like interweave like the things that were tropes of negativity towards Black youth, like the hoodie being a power of using that as a symbol of empathy for the child as part of his jetpack. And in True, it was maybe like 2019. I just remember a story, and maybe it was on Facebook. A lot of people I went to high school with became cops, and they were criminalizing everybody who was at Caribbean carnivals and like saying that they were calling them animals. This was before like all the cops changed their name to like Black names to troll people, which was another thing that still goes on Facebook. And I wanted a story that just had teenage Black youth at Caribbean carnival enjoying the last party before school started. So I knew like whatever I wanted to do had to start there, and I wanted to do that, and I wanted to capture that feeling. I wanted to capture the feeling of how important a grandma is. So that was something I wanted to capture, like how important that figure is. Because a lot of times whether you have one parent or two parents, that parent's at work. And I want like the grandparent is the person who's like raising you, or the aunt or the uncle or somebody else. And I wanted to capture that kind of character. And the resilience and the, you know, again, there's always these like Black stereotypes that go in as like negative, like because of this disenfranchisement of like the Black family. There are all these stories where like there's a guiding force, and he is very much motivated by wanting to do stuff for his grandma. And that's like something that pulls him. And also like, you know, realizing that he doesn't have all the answers and the mistakes that he's going to make because he thinks that he has control of other people's stories and he doesn't. So he has to learn a lot. So that kind of thing was important to me, is like capturing images that I didn't see represented.
I write to answer questions that I can't answer in my own life. So for Free Period, I realized I just had so much trauma about my own period from when I was little that when I became a parent, I said, oh my God, how am I going to talk about this in a positive way? And so we're talking about who we write for. I write for an audience of one, and I just take 60,000 words, you know, to figure out how I'm going to answer each big question in my life. And what I kept coming back to was friendship. Like, it was my friends that got me through all the hard times in middle school. And so that's what I wanted to write about. And I just make sure that the girls in my books, they get to be wild. They get to have fun. They get to do the things that we typically say for boys, boys can be boys. But I want to make sure that the girls get to do all of that in my book. And I want girls to like know that they can have fun with the tough things that we see in life without being made fun of.
Do you want to?
I'm gonna get really professorial and analytical.
Go for it.
No one wants that.
So you're not.
I can do the next question.
Okay. Okay. Do you want to pick the next
question? Sure. I don't know who asked which question. I know you know.
How about that?
Okay. So when you were younger, did you enjoy writing? And what kind of things did you write?
Very bad poetry.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes it's like, oh, you saved that, Mom. You know, let's make that go away.
I loved writing when I was a kid, and I knew I wanted to be a writer, and I went to college, and I was going to be a playwright, and I came out of school a playwright, and I was really lucky. I moved to the city. I found myself in a theater company. I had amazing mentors. I had it all right there, and it was too hard. I wasn't ready to do, like, the real work of writing. You know, I'd write something. I'm miming a typewriter here because that's how old I am. And I'd, you know, rip it out and I'd be like, hi, look at what I did. And somebody would be like, okay, great, good. Now, keep going, keep working, keep digging. And I honestly wasn't ready to do the really hard work of writing. And so I had to sort of run away and I did a different career for about 15 years. And then when I had my kids, I was like, you know what, it's time. And I sat down and now, oddly enough, my favorite part of writing is the revision, is really digging back in. So I was somebody who knew they wanted to be a writer, but it wasn't going to happen too early for me.
I wrote tons of magazines that I sent to a 17 magazine. I would send them tons of stories and always be shocked that they were not published. The twist was always that everyone was dead. It was like something maudlin and horrendous. So yeah, it just took like another 30 years to come up with something that other people might want to read.
I wrote a lot when I was a kid. I think it was almost easier when I was less self-conscious, when I was 9 or 10. So when I was 9 years old, my parents, I'm very much first generation, and so going to things like summer camp was fairly unusual, but, you know, to go away for that. But my father had a friend who sent me off, and so I went to the summer camp, which I hated, and so I would slip away at nap time and work on my novel. And illustrated it, actually. But it was a total ripoff of a movie I'd seen that I loved. But I did write it. And then again wrote another one, which was told from the 8 different points of view. It was like a gang. And I remember when some adult read it, said, that's a very, very nice gang that you've written. So, you know. But it was, I guess, it was actually easier when I was younger, is I guess what I would say, is when I ultimately wanted to become an author as an adult, there's a lot more self-consciousness that kicks in, and it wasn't as free. It took a little while before I found my footing.
I wanted a career with animals. I wanted to be a veterinarian or something else to do with animals, and I just like to write. I love to write. I had the diaries and the journals, and yes, I sent things off to the magazine too, to 17. I had a poem published when I was 16, so that was my big 17 moment. But writing was an avocation. I just loved to write. I was the editor of the school newspaper and the editor of my college literary magazine, and yet I was double majoring in biology and chemistry. So I ended up senior year, thankfully, was a gift at Audubon Magazine as an intern for a full year, and that really put all the things together, and I actually went in as working for the photography editor, because at that point I also love photography, and I've photographed many of my books, so it's still a passion of mine. And it was my mentor who kept me there a year and had me starting to write things that said, you're a writer. And I somehow listened and ended up writing, but it was not, it was my way now of writing about science and combining all of those things that I like. So although I still also play a little bit in the fiction realm, it's primarily the science that comes out.
So hi, this is Jennifer to Differentiate Voices. For me, I think it's really important to clarify that my family was super, super supportive of writing as whatever I wanted to do. They were supportive of everything you wanted to do as long as you would move out.
fair.
You can get paid. Bye. And so I was taught to read very young by my aunt, who took care of me, speaking to like Don's point of like how we're raised in communities and by families who might be working and doing all these things that are present but not always present, right? And so my aunt is a big reader. My mother is a big reader. My grandmother is a big reader. The women in my family were very big bibliophiles. Mm-hmm. And so you could read whatever you want. You could write whatever you want. Do whatever you want. And so similarly, I went to high school and wrote for the school literary magazine. I wrote bad poetry as well. And I still write bad poetry, but my prose has gotten much better. And I wrote horror stories called Terror Bound, where it was kind of Buffy-esque, so I'm aging myself because I was born in a whole other century, that it was like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, where a bunch of your friends, you know, took care of monsters, you know, and it's like all of us in Queens, these kids of color in Queens, and it's our teacher, and she didn't like me using the name. The history teacher, who we all had an issue with, Mrs. Maffei, sorry to shout you out like that. But like she was like, you cannot use my name. And so we're like, can we not? Really? And then because it was the school literary magazine, they're like, no, we can't. So the teacher we all liked was like, you can use my name. But we're like, now it's unbelievable. Like, this is weird. But we needed it. And so like having those monster stories, and I presented just the other day to some students about, you know, things like Spy Kids or The Goonies or like Attack the Block, where teenagers or preteens or young kids in elementary school are the saviors. They're the heroes because they're seeing what the people don't. Like vampires in the Bronx. No one believes the kids. They're like, they're vampires. We don't believe you. What are you watching on the internet? What's ridiculous? But the kids know. They're like, something is wrong. Mm-hmm. And so that level of imagination that kind of gets kind of stymied the more you're becoming an adult, because you're paying taxes and you got responsibilities and you can eat whatever you want, but it's still like you still got to pay taxes. You know what I mean? Like you have to deal with these real world things that I think it's not that young kids don't, but there's still that like openness to like what's possible. And then allowing and respecting that reader. So when you're in that age, I think you can feel it, but it's like what some folks were saying, carrying that to your stories in present day to make sure you're respecting the teen reader as well. Mm-hmm. And so because that was always nurtured for me, I never saw that as not something to do. Mm-hmm. It was just something I realized maybe I needed to part that from what I made money from to enjoy the freedom of writing itself. And so I kind of impart that too when I talk to anybody of any age of like, can you still get the joy and freedom of writing without worrying about the paycheck? Because sometimes that affects the work itself. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love everything you said, especially the sharing in the literary magazine. That's so good. I think there were people. I definitely wrote from the time I kept those journals I was talking about. I want to say middle school is when I started to really seriously write and document what was happening, and so much bad poetry. I'm with you all on that. But I went to this program called the Kentucky Governor School for the Arts when I was 17. It still exists. It's a free program. You audition into it and you have 3 weeks of art making, like steady. Our teacher said to us, if you don't, you know, you'll know if you want to be a writer after these 3 weeks, because we're going to be doing it nonstop. And they were transformative to me. There were three writers who were two of my main teachers, Kelly Norman Ellis and Frank X. Walker, and then Crystal Wilkinson, who was a guest at the time, who were Afro-Latchin poets. And when you looked in the dictionary, I was saying I was born in the 70s. I went into, you know, that program. I was 17 or so. It was the 90s. And if you looked in the dictionary, it said Appalachian white residents of the Appalachian Mountains. And my teachers were black and they were writers and they existed. So Frank X. Walker said, no, we all exist. There's writers of color in the Appalachian Mountains. We're going to coin the phrase Afro-Latchian poets. And those teachers said to us, you need to own who you are. If you don't call your grandma or grandpa, if you call them mama or mima or abuela, the idea that your culture and who your traditions were your superpowers. And that changed everything for me. My mom is a Syrian American. For me to talk about my Middle Eastern roots wasn't something I had done necessarily. And so they cracked open for me the telling your story or honoring, owning, valuing who you are. And so everybody in that classroom was like, oh, right, I have a voice. Me too. And so there was a way for us to see ourselves and love ourselves and love our unique voices. I think that was sort of a gift for me that was given at 17. And I feel like I'm trying to carry that 17-year-old self with me.
Anyone else want to weigh in, or
we can move on? I started writing on my sister's typewriter. She had the old mechanical typewriter.
Nice.
And whenever I was depressed, if I typed on those keys, it made me happy.
Oh, that's great. That's,
even if it got stuck. Remember when they'd all like get stuck?
Yeah, all get stuck. But it was like almost like I don't know how everyone else writes, but there's these moments where you can't write and there's nothing coming out, and doing something physical frees up my brain. And then all of a sudden I could figure out so it's like almost like he got stuck on the right time, like, yeah. Oh, I don't know what I'm writing. And then it's just like, oh, wait, I know what AI is now. Mm-hmm. So I'm thankful for the keys that got stuck.
Nice. Yeah. Let's see what other questions we have. What do you appreciate most about writing for kids or teens? Or I guess mostly teens for this group.
So I write for the tweens.
Tweens.
I write for tweens. So I don't think there is anybody funnier than a 10-year-old. Like, you don't know if they're going to hit you with an epic fart joke or, like, just scathing satire. I think we were talking about, like, that they see things, that kids see things that other people don't. And I think that their humor is fresh and real, and I love tapping into that because I try to infuse all my stories with humor. Yeah, so that's why.
Yeah, I think, this is Alyssa, I keep forgetting to do that, thank you for the reminder. Because I write for middle grade readers, sort of 10 to 12 year olds, I think I remember that time in my life, and I think it is a brilliant moment where you do not think of yourself any longer as a child, but you are not being regarded as an adult, but you are starting to see the world through a whole different lens, and you're starting to realize that, again, those stories that you've been told, they may not be true, and the adults in your life, as wonderful or as unreliable as they may be, whichever you have, they don't actually have all the answers, and that it's up to all of us as individuals to go out and look for the truths that we can find. I think it's just this beautiful, nice edge, and I write for people that age because I want them to hold on to their strength and their truths, and that wide-opened curiosity about the world.
I think a lot about the inner life of young people and bringing that to light, because it can often be sort of squashed down. But I also think of it as an adult writing for young people. I think a lot about trying to cultivate empathy, that you may be reading a story that this person has, like, sort of doesn't have your background, but some way in which you can step through in the book and feel empathy. And also feel complexity, because I think that as much as I love them all, teenagers, they also, having raised two teenage boys, there's a kind of black and white, you know, way of seeing things, very, you know, like so wanting in the heat of the moment to see things in these really straightforward ways. And so I'm hoping a book can be a way that you enter into this space that's honoring their inner experience, and sort of cultivates this empathy and capacity to see the complexity of the world. And not perhaps become the judgmental adults that everybody becomes, you know, that maybe we can keep that door open a little more.
This is Jennifer again, and I want to agree with Allie. I agree with everybody for the most part. So I'm being very like, that's right. So about the humor levels of young people, but there's also a level of kind of just awareness that I really love about young people, and too, because there's just an honesty, too, right? And I have to say, like, nothing made my week better than a seventh grade girl telling me I was pretty. Like, you can't tell me anything today. Because I was like, y'all can be vicious. So this was lovely. but it's also the fact that it's like, when I was a teen and a kid, I felt like there was this just thing, you know, like this bridge you cross when you become an adult. And I felt lied to. Honestly, like when I became 21, 22, you just feel like, okay, things are legal now. I can do things now. Awesome. And then you're like, but people can still be awful and people can still be insecure and you don't suddenly become self-aware and you don't necessarily stop losing being overly aware of what people think and you don't necessarily know more immediately. Like there's just this way I've looked at adulthood as a literal gate you passed and everything opened up to you and all the knowledge and things that adults have bestowed upon me was something I'm like, I get that now, right? And it's like, no, that's not what happens. And so I respect the age group and the generational divide to an extent, but I also recognize, like, I talk to people like people. And so when I talk to someone who's 17, 16, 10, 5, I talk to them in the same way. Because I just respect the fact that certain things never change, but you also respect where you're at. And so even engaging with young people with this book, hearing these really, really deep thoughts, deeper than some that I've had with adults, and being like, oh, this, it's intersectional in that way. It intersperses, it interconnects all those words. Because realistically, you can always be childish. You can always have those elements. And so I really love writing for this group because I respect that group so deeply and I learn from that group. And I think that's where some of the best writing for young people comes from, is the people who respect the reader and really understand what that was like everyone in this room. And so that's why I like writing for that, because I feel like sometimes when you write for adults, you're getting into this really, really like analytical framework of like, well, this is meaning this and this is the symbolism of this. It's like, I don't care, did it happen, did it not happen, like what's going on, like what are we trying to say, and that kind of directness without losing style, without losing craft, is something that's not lost on young readers.
I want to say this, and this is Ellen. There's something I do. I love writing. I'm like trying to convince myself. I do love it, but it is lonely. It's hard. I feel like if I'm not getting it right, I struggle or grapple with writing. But connecting with young people, that feels like the biggest joy, or connecting with other writers, or being like, oh, what are you doing, and how do we be in community together. I think about young people figuring out how to own their own art making too. I spent the week, we were prepping for this art festival that happens at the end of May. It's for schools all across the Bronx. And so kids are getting on this stage for the first time, a 500-seat theater, and they're feeling the spotlight on their face, or they're doing a dance move and people are liking it and they get it, or they hear their voice on the microphone amplified for the first time. And that to me is being in conversation with young people who are, oh, I am an artist too, or here's how I want to express my art. That's the best part of being an artist, like that, or being in community with people, all figuring out how do we make art together, how do we dialogue, and how do we, how do we show each other the jump off points from art making. That feels like the best part about writing for young people or writing in general. That feels like the biggest joy.
I had a situation, this is Nancy, I had a situation where I was being interviewed and an adult environmental activist asked me, why do you write for kids? Because they can't do anything.
And I took it as a personal affront. Like, I write, and I remember coming back with a very sharp answer saying, that's absolutely false. You know, that my teenagers that I write for, my young readers, probably do a lot more than a lot of adults these days. And it doesn't take a bank account or a corporate account, which is what she was trying to say. That is the thing that we all need. And I find that when I write for kids, I am engaged with their curiosity and their passion. And I love that aspect. Kids have that, they can have a passion about what they want to do and how they can achieve it. And I think a lot of times it's probably superior to a lot of adults, and we get mired in not believing things can happen. And I think kids still have that ability to see what can happen. Mm-hmm. And I really love being involved in that aspect of getting involved in what can be as opposed to what is.
Wonderful. We have about 9 minutes left for our segment. So I wanted to give everyone the opportunity, if there's anything that you wanted to share, anything you're excited about, anything coming down the line that you're working on, that you're able to talk about, whatever you want to say as a parting message to our radio listeners.
I'm excited about everybody's book. I'm so happy to hear about this. A free period sounds amazing.
Oh, thank you.
I didn't even know that was a uterus. That's
amazing. Can I build on that? This is Allie to say what I'm excited about. So this is not about me selling a book, but May is Menstrual Health Awareness Month, in addition to being a lot of other recognition months. But so May is Menstrual Health Awareness Month. The last week of May is Period Poverty Awareness Week. And so this is a great time to just check in with yourself and anyone else in your life to say, like, am I getting the care that I need? Because a lot of us aren't. And if you aren't, who in your life can you talk to? Is it your parent? Is it your caregiver? Is it a nurse at school? Is it an educator at school? You know, right now, whether we have what we need depends a lot on where we live and what services are available. But if we're willing to talk about it, we might be able to get more. So if everyone could just take a moment this May to think that through, I think we'd all be in a better place.
Thank you for that. Can we shout out our friend? I want to shout out Shannon Rogers, who's also here, and her new book, 18 Roses, is coming out. Oh, but cool. She's here for her debut, which won the Apollo Award, Asian Pacific Islander ALA Award. So I want to shout out Shannon Rogers, who, if you come tomorrow, you'll meet her. And she's
very
wonderful.
Cool.
Okay. Anyone else want to say any last hurrahs?
Just excited for tomorrow.
Yeah.
And to meet readers and talk to readers. And
it's a great festival every year. And I know many of you have been here. But it's such a treat for authors, illustrators, as well as folks coming in from the community, because we get to enjoy each other. And, you know, I can't remember who was saying it over there, if it was Ellen or Jen saying, you know, it is such a solitary business.
Yeah.
And festivals like this really enable us to enjoy each other's company and each other's work, as well as talking to all of our young readers.
Yeah.
So it's like a moment of group therapy. Are you going to do this too? Yeah. Jen will be there like, okay, Don, it's okay. You're not. It's fine.
And I do love when they come and say, hey, I'm writing this story, and they start to tell you about it. And I'm like, that is so cool, because it did not occur to me to be writing a story when I was 12.
Yeah.
I grew up in rural Idaho. There were lots of things I could do, but I didn't see anybody doing that job. I didn't know that was a job. And so to see kids like doing that much earlier than I thought to do it is always fun for me.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, thank you all so much for joining us today to talk about your work and your books. We're so excited to see you tomorrow at the Book Festival. For all our radio listeners, the Hudson Children's Book Festival is tomorrow, Saturday, May 4th, from 10 to 3 at the Hudson Junior Senior High School. And you should come meet all of our author friends there. Check out their work. You can ask them any questions that we didn't get to today on the radio. But yeah, thank you all for joining us. I hope you enjoy your time in Hudson. Or I know you're here frequently, but I still hope you enjoy your time in Hudson.
I will.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Happy Book Fest weekend. So to our radio listeners, we're going to pause for a moment. We're still going to be on the air, but we're going to pause for a moment while we switch out our authors for some younger, I don't know if they're younger, but people that write for a younger crowd. So we'll be right back.
doble potrillo que justo en la raya afloja al llegar y que al regresar parece decir no olvides hermano, otra vez no hay que jugar. Por una cabeza me te escondí un día de aquella coqueta y risueña mujer. Y al corazón riendo del amor que está mintiendo, quema en una hoguera todo mi querer. Por una cabeza todas las locuras, tu boca que besa borra la tristeza, calma la amargura. Por una cabeza y ella me olvida. ¿Qué importa perderme mil veces la vida? ¿Para qué vivir? Cuánto desengaño por una cabeza. Yo juré mil veces, no vuelvo a insistir. Pero si un mirar me hiere al pasar, tu boca de fuego no te lo quiero dar. Basta de carrera, se acabó la timba, un final reñido yo no vuelvo a ver. Pero si algún vino llega a ser fija el domingo, yo me juego entero, ¿qué le voy a hacer? Por una cabeza. Tu boca que besa borra la tristeza, calma la amargura. Por una cabeza y ella me olvida. ¿Qué importa perderme mil veces la vida? ¿Para qué vivir?
Te he perdido tantas veces, inevitable es el recuerdo y la angustia del reencuentro de tu piel contra mi piel. Me ha costado tanto y tanto que ya mi alma se marchita y se deshacen lagrimitas que se olvidaron de rezar. Y si yo hubiera sabido que para ti era tan poco, hubiera sido más prudente al entregarte el corazón. Y si yo hubiera sabido que para ti todo era un juego, aquel verano entre tus besos no hubiera escrito esta canción. Poco a poco perdiendo la claridad de tu retrato, pero no olvido ni un segundo el dulce tacto de tu
For those just tuning in, this is Emily, the director of the Hudson Area Library, and we're broadcasting from the Hudson Area Library Teen Room. I'm In addition to being the library director, I'm the co-host of the Bound by Books Youth Radio Show on WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, and beyond. And I'm joined by Amelia, who was a longtime member of Bound by Books and is now a library staff member, and was also a Hudson City School District graduate. Mm-hmm. Has been to the Book Fest many, many years, possibly all 13, unless you were out of town or sick or something, as have I. And we're very excited to have another group of authors and illustrators here with us now to talk about their work and to celebrate the Book Festival. So I also have a special guest with us today, someone who helps bring the Hudson Children's Book Festival to our community each year, which is one of our library favorites, Marlene Parmentier. Yay!
And as Emily said, this is our 13th year, which it's hard to believe that it's our 13th year already. It's the second biggest children's book fest in New York State, and we have authors and illustrators from all over the world. Our mission has always been to get books into the hands of children, and we try to expose them to diverse and quality books. We give the Hudson City School District a good four coupon, so every student that goes to the Hudson City School District gets to go tomorrow and go up to a booth and get a free signed book from an author. So that's pretty awesome.
Okay. Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. So I introduced myself and Amelia, but we want our radio listeners to hear who's in the room with us. I'm hoping each of you can just give a quick little introduction about yourself and your books. It can be up to, you know, like a few minutes or so, as at 1 to 3 minutes, something like that. And then what we'll do afterwards, it doesn't have to be, no pressure. It can be 30 seconds. It can be 10 seconds. I'm just saying, you don't have to do the elevator pitch if you don't want to.
Where's your microphone? I can hear.
Yeah, okay. We're using the Waveform app. Shout out to the Waveform app to do our remote broadcast today. But yeah, so we're just going to introduce ourselves, and then we'll have a conversation all at once.
1, 2, 3, and everybody talks.
You can tell this is the picture book crew. But yeah, so we'll take our turns one at a time.
I'm going first. My name is Gabrielle Balkan. I usually go by Gabe, rarely Gabby, unless there's someone really loves saying Gabby, and then I like hearing them say it. Nice. And so I write... research and write nonfiction for kids, and this year my two big books for the Hudson Book Festival are What a Map Can Do, which follows a raccoon going on different adventures, some silly, some serious, and the idea for that book is to have kids really engage with their community and taking charge of their own adventures. And the second book I have this year is Meet the Megafauna, which is more for like a 4th, 5th grade audience, and it's about really big animals. And I was so pleased to visit with some Hudson students yesterday and had a great reception there. So I really am grateful to all that you guys do. It's a big, big job, and you do it beautifully.
Gosh, okay. I don't usually like doing this because I'm a rambler and I tend to go off topic. I go off roading.
Reel me in.
So my name is Jackie Asua Kramer, and this is my second Hudson Valley Children's Book Festival, which I'm so excited to be a part of. And I'm from Long Island, New York. And yes, I write picture books, nonfiction and fiction. And I can see you have a couple of my books here. My latest is a book called Rhythm, and it's about a little girl who finds hope and inspiration in this old tree in her community that's struggling with food insecurity and unemployment. And through the seasons, the rhythms of the season, she finds this kind of hope and connection to her community. I've had like 3 other books come out this year, so I don't want to be sort of braggy. But
you did that.
You did so much crying to get to this point.
Exactly. Struggle. So Boogie in the Bronx is another one that came out, and that book is now in Spanish and English. Mm-hmm. And it's a book for kids who love to dance and want to learn about the Bronx itself. And it's also a concept book because you're counting 1 to 10 till you get to the big block party at the end. And the one before that is We Are One, And that's a book about how we are all connected to each other and to the natural world, and what about those connections. And then the one before that might have been, oh no, Empanadas for Everyone, which is a book about a little girl who loves making empanadas with her tia Mimi. And every Saturday, but this Saturday, Thea Mimi has to go help at the meal center. Mm-hmm. So she has to make the empanadas all on her own, and how she finds out that the community helps her to do that, and how resourceful she really is. But there you have it.
That was pretty on topic. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That was well done. That was great. I'm Susan Verde, and I write picture books for kids, mostly fiction. And this is my second, I think, time at the festival, pre-COVID and now this time. And I had a great visit this morning with some first graders.
So that was fantastic.
So fun. I love it so much. That's like the best part of the job. So what books? Let's see. I think the book that's featured at the festival is not in that pile. So pointing to it doesn't help me at all, Josh, but thanks. There's a book called Are You Listening? So I, in addition to writing, I teach yoga and mindfulness, and a lot of my books have that kind of feeling infused in them about really paying attention and being in the moment and that kind of thing. So Are You Listening is all about really listening, not just hearing things that go on, but really listening and getting to the deeper message of whatever it is that you're in the midst of. And then I have Who I Am, Words I Tell Myself. So it's a book of positive affirmations that's pulled from all of my I Am series books, pulled the illustrations, and then we have all these affirmations. So that's kind of what I'm about. That's it.
I'm Josh Funk. I'm a software engineer during the day, and I write children's picture books for children, but also the adults that read to them. My most popular book series is Lady Pancake and Sir French Toast, which is illustrated by Brendan Kearney. And I have a book called My Pet Feet, which is illustrated by Billy Yong, which if students have done the March Book Madness, it was in the March Book Madness the last couple of years. But my newest book is called Dear Unicorn, which is illustrated by Charles Santoso. It is about a girl and a unicorn who are pen pals, but they don't realize they're writing to a different species. So they misunderstand each other's letters. In addition, so I wrote this book because I got the idea in line at the Slinky Dog Dash roller coaster in Disney World, and it was a really, really long line, and I was very upset that it was going to be in line for 5 hours, but I also was like, but I'm in Disney World and then everything's great. And then I was like, but then we turned a corner and it was like even longer on the other side of the wall. And so, I thought, you know, it'd be fun to write a book about a character who's positive and a character who's negative. So, the human in this book is very, very negative, and the unicorn is very positive. So they're writing letters to each other with very different perspectives on life. I actually wrote the entire first draft of the book while in line.
It was that long.
Huh? It wasn't worth it, by the way. I mean, I love Disney, if you're listening, but it was 45 seconds. I would skip. But yeah, so it's these two characters have different perspectives, and one is very positive, one is very negative, but they sort of become friends over the year throughout by sending letters and art to each other. Mm-hmm. And that is my book. And it's my second time here. Again, like Susan, I was before the pandemic, and now, so I'm excited to be back. It's been 6 or 7 years.
All right.
Paul.
My name is Paul Sajak. I'm a children's book author as well. I'm also a chemist. I'm a chemist by day, and I do this when I can. This is actually, I've been to this festival several times. I love this festival. It's my favorite festival. So this doesn't reach Chappaqua, does it?
We don't tell them. You love them too.
I don't know. So I have what I say. I'm probably most, if you've gone to this festival, I'm probably most known for my monster books, Monster Needs a Sleep, Monster Needs a Party. I actually have, what I say, 1.5 new books out this year. So the half of new book is actually from the Monster series. It's Monster Needs to Go to School. I actually wrote it and sold it years ago, but it never became a book. This is the first year they actually put it out as a book. They lost, you know, the publisher lost distribution, and then they were able to get it back, and it's, you know, it's the publishing world. We don't need to go down that. But I'm really excited that I finally get to actually hold it. I haven't even gotten a copy. Like, I finally get to hold this book. And then the other new book is actually going to be released. Its birthday is in August. But I talked to the publisher, and they're actually sending copies for this particular festival. So, again, I haven't even seen this book yet. So this will be the first time I get to see it. And it's called A Peculiar Haunted House. And it's about a haunted house that wants to be a haunted house. It wants nothing to do with being having a family, so it scares everybody away until a particular family, very peculiar, comes in and actually is really into what the house is all about. So it's about finding your people, I guess you could say. Yeah, that's pretty much it. I'm really excited to finally see it and hold it.
Cool. My name is Natasha Tarpley. This is my first time at the festival. I'm very excited because I wanted to come before the pandemic, but this is my first time here, so I'm very excited to be here. I write picture books as well as middle grade, and also venturing into writing narrative or dramatic podcasts. So I'm really interested in exploring all the ways to kind of engage with and entertain young readers and their families. So my most well-known book is a picture book called I Love My Hair, which came out over 20 years ago. I will date myself. But fortunately, that book has continued to have a very long and expansive life, and I'm very grateful for that. My most recent books are actually inspired by I Love My Hair. There's a series out, I have a series out called Kiana Loves, and that series is a picture book series that has the protagonist is inspired by the protagonist of I Love My Hair. The little girl in I Love My Hair talks about all the wonderful ways that she likes to wear her hair, and we see her imagination and her joyfulness and her curiosity. But I was always curious about who she was as a person and what her family life looked like and what she might do in her everyday life. So that inspired this new series called Kiana Loves, which is about a little girl who just really has big ideas and does what she can to bring them to fruition. And sometimes they don't work out. And she has a really wonderful network of family and friends to kind of work with her on bringing those ideas to fruition. So it's a book about just kind of exploring your own creativity and having perseverance and believing in your ideas. I'm not sure, but there another book that may be at the festival is called The Me I Choose to Be, which is a picture book that won Coretta Scott King Art Award, not this year, but last year. And it's just a wonderful book of portraits that with a narrative poem that really just talk about celebrating who you are and also the power that we have within ourselves to choose who we are and not allow other people to define that for us. So really happy to be here.
Hi, my name is Rich Michelson, and my day job is I own our Michelson Galleries, which was the first gallery in the country to start selling original children's book illustrations. I handled the careers of people like Jerry Pinkney, Brian Collier, Mo Willems, etc. I also write both for adults, teens, and children. I'm here because of my picture books. Most of them are probably some are just fun poetry, the sort of thing that we're going to hear about from my friend here next, Alan Kett. Probably I'm best known for my books on race and social justice,
I also write a lot of books about Jewish heritage. As good as anybody, Martin Luther King and Abraham Joshua Heschel's Amazing March Towards Freedom is probably my best-known book. That won the Sidney Taylor Gold Medal, which is given every year for the best book of the year that has a Jewish theme. I won a second Sidney Taylor, I'm happy to say, in 2018 for my book, The Language of Angels. And I'm here for my new book, which is a biography of Sidney Taylor. After learning about her, some people might know Sidney Taylor for her All of a Kind Family Books, which was the first book published in this country that had Jewish characters that became popular outside of a Jewish audience. And Sidney Taylor really was the first person to kick down the walls of multiculturalism and really bring what is a very necessary and current, you know, what we're all trying to do is have books for everyone, so windows and mirrors, so you can see yourself, you can see other people. And that started with Sidney Taylor and her All of a Kind family. My book is called One of a Kind, The Life of Sidney Taylor, and that is my latest. A couple of other books I see of mine here across the alley about two kids who aren't allowed to play with each other during the time of segregation during the day, but at night their bedroom windows face each other and they become best friends. I have a Oh No, Not Ghosts I See There, which is just a kind of fun Halloween book. A is for Abraham is over there. What else? Why don't you have the rest of them? I drove 2 hours.
They're very heavy.
Anyway, so I thank you, and thank I you see too.
Well, that's very nice. Thank you. I'm Alan Katz. Never Al, but Alan. Although my Craig Tarasoff, who will be my son-in-law 7 weeks from tonight, has taken to calling me Al. So we decided that I'm the Al in Festival, which seems to justify it. I think it's my eighth time here at this wonderful, wonderful festival, and honored to be back. I'm the probably best known for Take Me Out of the Bathtub and other silly dilly songs, which turned 23 on this past week, and has just been banned in Katy, Texas, because there's a naked tushy on the cover. Can I say tushy? Is that right? There is a naked tushy on the cover, and I don't know what that's going to do to children everywhere. But their silly dilly songs like Stinky Stinky Diaper Change to the tune of Twinkle Twinkle Little Star practically wrote itself. And I'm here with a new book called Got Your Nose. My son Andrew is a political speechwriter, and he was getting on the train in Connecticut to go back to Washington, D.C., and he reached out, he hugged me, he kissed me, as we always do. And he said, "Hey, Dad, got your nose." And I said, "Don't take my nose to Washington, D.C." Well, I went back to the car and I said, "Wait a minute. You know, that's like Josh standing on line at Disney." That was like an aha moment. What about a grandpa and his granddaughter who play Got Your Nose, but grandpa inadvertently does take her nose. And the chase is on because the nose runs away because, after all, noses run. And, thank you for laughing at that. And there's a spot in the park where a woman on a bench says, "Look, there's a girl with no nose." And the other woman says, "I just saw a nose with no girl. It was a beautiful nose, too. If I could pick any nose, I'd certainly pick that one." So those are the jokes. And it ends, well, I won't tell you how it ends, except it ends in a way that I'm very proud that kids are writing their own sequels, which is wonderful. Although I don't need the competition, I love the fact that it inspires creativity. So hopefully we'll see some kids with and without noses at the festival. If you come and say hi, I do have plastic pencil sharpeners shaped like noses. Okay. And just come say hi. And that's, you know, my gift to America.
You don't want to get those mixed up with real noses.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely
not.
That sounds
really uncomfortable.
Absolutely not.
Do they run too? Or?
If you throw them, they'll go. But they're very cute. They're, you know, it's a sharpener, which inspires creativity too.
Exactly.
Wonderful. Well, thank you all for introducing yourselves. I always love hearing from the authors and illustrators instead of just reading a bio. So it's nice to hear you introduce yourselves. So we're going to ask some questions that we have, but also if you all ever have questions for each other, whether for one person or for the group, feel free to chime in. We just want to have a nice conversation for the rest of the show. So some of our Bound by Books radio show co-hosts couldn't make it today, so they sent us some questions. So I'm going to ask one of those to get us started. And I think, so we're all authors here. I mean, aside from maybe, well, actually you're an author, but there's no illustrators here today, right? Everybody.
Unfortunately, I wish I were both.
No, this is a safe space.
I realized that. I was thinking we had illustrators here too. So for all of you working with other illustrators, what is that process like? How do you work? Do any of you, I know it changes from author to author, but do any of you work very closely with the illustrator? Is it more of a, oh, actually, we have one other author joining us now. Yay. We'll grab you a chair.
Welcome.
Lindsay, you got to introduce yourself. You're live on the radio.
We have another author to introduce. Welcome. So we're on the radio. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So we just went around and did some introductions. Okay. So if you don't mind introducing yourself and just saying a little bit about your book.
I'd love to. My name is Emo Yuksev. I'm the author of several picture books. My first one is titled In My Mosque, and it's about mosques around the world and the types of activities and services that take place in them. My second book is a picture book biography about Fatma al-Fihri, who built the world's oldest university in the world over 1,200 years ago. If there are kids listening out there, I like to say that with emphasis, in Fez, Morocco, and it's still functioning, operating as a university today. And my two recent books came out this year, Ramadan Kareem. It's about the holy month of Ramadan and how it's celebrated around the world by different cultures. And my newest book came out a few weeks ago. It's called Sami's Special Gift, and it's about Eid al-Adha. And I apologize for being late because I thought we were doing this individually.
Wonderful.
Well, to be fair, Alan was late too. We just didn't get to him until
outing Alan.
Everybody, there's an hour's worth of construction in Danbury, Connecticut. So come to the festival and don't go to Danbury.
Yeah. Good plan.
Well, I have a question for Alan. You've been here 8 times?
Yes.
How does your wife feel about spending her anniversary 8 times?
Well, it's true. It's our anniversary.
Oh, happy anniversary.
On
happy
Tuesday, anniversary. It's Yay. Yeah. What's the joke?
No, I just
23 happy years or 34 in all. we love coming. We love, you know, there are friendly people, and I get to see you.
He's pointing at me, Josh.
Yeah. So a question for the authors in the room is, what is it like working with an illustrator? Do you work closely with them? Do you kind of see the final product when it arrives? How does that work?
Yeah. I think it depends on the illustrator as well and the publisher. But most times, I've heard all kinds of stories, but I've been blessed that I can communicate usually through the editor and then the art director. But I have, in some cases, connected directly with the illustrator. So, for example, my book, The Boy and the Gorilla, there is no dialogue. It's just, it's all dialogue. And Cindy Derby is the illustrator for that book. Amazing illustrator. And I had art notes, which is something kind of, at least I've been told, kind of verboten unless you really need to share, you know, that the editor won't understand or see what it is you're trying to communicate in that moment. But I had art notes for almost every moment in the story. Mm-hmm. And Liz Bignell of Candlewick Press published a book, and Cindy Derby got in touch with her, and she said, "Does Jackie have any thoughts on the art for this?" And I was like honored. Oh my gosh, she wants to see. So they forwarded all my art notes to her, and pretty much, I almost feel like I illustrated the book, because pretty much everything that I said, she drew, she illustrated, and the result, for those of you who've seen it, wouldn't you say, Cindy's? It was just really beautiful, I think personally. But yeah, it's just, it depends. I don't know how.
I've never worked with the illustrators. It all went through the publisher. Even with the series, with Monster, my Monster and Me series, there's, you know, about 6 books in that series, and not once did I really ever work with the illustrator to portray the. Yeah.
I mean, that's fairly standard in the industry. Yeah. You know, you work with the editor
and the art director.
The illustrator does, because they don't want. Mm-hmm. You know, the illustrator needs to have their own input, and they don't want you saying, mm-hmm. oh, no, but my shirt was red, that sort of thing. For me, it's a little odd, because it's not that infrequent that somebody who I represent at my gallery illustrates my books. So sometimes we pretend we're not talking to each other. I'm right now working on my third book with E.B. Lewis, who's an amazing illustrator. He did my Across the Alley. He did a book we did called Happy Feet. And now we're doing a book that'll be out next year, called Next Year in the White House. And it's about Obama, who did the very first ever Seder in the White House. And we're going to get to meet Obama. That's really cool. But
which one?
Well, we really are hoping to meet Michelle, but I think we're going to be stuck with Barack. You know, just to hold the book up. With, we have the same publisher that is it. But, you know, so they work. You work separately. When I'm working with my friends, they'll often say, oh, don't tell the editor. I did. What do you think of this? What do you think of that? And, you know, that's kind of fun. For me, it's odd, because a lot of my illustrators... when I'm not working on their books, I work with them, just, you know, they show me what they're doing, what I think, et cetera. And then suddenly, when I'm working on my own book, I'm not supposed to do that. So it feels a little awkward to me. But it's fun. You know, I've gotten to work with Raul Colon, Barry Mosier, all people who have become friends.
I have a question, though, for all of you. Do any of you get sketches ever? Preliminary sketches?
Yes.
Just the editorial.
Yeah.
So yeah. there is some kind of... They do look for your feedback.
Yeah.
I'll go.
Usually the feedback is just, we can get rid of these words now, because... I don't need them. I'm actually curious for some of the nonfiction writers and Susan, because you probably need to have specific things to be correct in the illustrations. And also, Susan, some of your books with Peter Reynolds, like, are very poetic, but don't necessarily have specific things. Do you come up with the sort of illustrated plot?
Actually. Yeah. I work with many illustrators, but Peter Reynolds and I have done the majority of my work. He's illustrated, and we've also become very good friends. So. There is that sort of, you know, wink, wink, nod, nod, we're not going to talk to each other, but we do. But no, I even though we communicate, the only book that I had to give some sort of direction was I Am Yoga, because he wasn't a yogi, so he didn't know what the poses were. But otherwise, he just gets it. And I'm lucky in that he'll send me he'll text me a sketch or something and be like, what do you think? And then I'm like, oh my gosh, and that's about it. But yeah, and I also, he'll sometimes ask me, you know, what I was thinking in a certain stanza or a certain line or something, but then he does his own thing, so it's,
First of all, for the nonfiction though, I don't know.
I send, because when I'm researching the book, I'm also finding all sorts of stuff, and rather than make the illustrator waste their time, I'll usually send them photographs of the house, photographs of the person growing up, because I've already come across all that, and then You know, so I will send all my notes as far as the visual things, and they can, you know, take it from there.
Sometimes my art notes are longer than the actual manuscript text. But for what a map can do, which is illustrated by Alberto Lott, the art came first. So he had submitted his manuscript to my publisher and one of my best friends, Cecily Kaiser, and she loved his art and maps. Love her so much. And so she had tried to kind of make the maps work in-house, like figuring out how the text would go, and couldn't quite get it. And then I took his sketches and sort of crafted a different story within them. So then he redid it with that in mind. But it was a tricky situation because I wanted to respect his idea. And still, it was his idea to begin. But it ended up working really nicely. And we're working on a follow-up book together. And we did kind of go through the editor just to make sure everyone's feelings were being taken care of. But we brainstormed a little bit that way. And I had a friendship that almost got ruined by the two of us trying to come up with an idea together. It got really hard. We needed someone to kind of be the person in between to hear both of our voices.
I probably worked with 15 different illustrators over the years, met three or four of them, have never really, I mean, Alex Willen, who I should have said did Got Your Nose, we did meet this past year after the book was done. But mostly I just sit back and say, wow, you get it. That's incredible. Twice. I can remember twice where the joke depended on a certain illustration and I didn't have the art notes properly done. And the illustrations that came back totally killed the joke. There shouldn't have been that. One particular was a short story where the payoff was the illustration. And it was so wrong that I said, just take the story out. I don't want to make the person do it again. But they did. It wasn't as big a fix as I thought it was. The other one was, and I'm embarrassed to say I've worked with David Catro or Catro. Anybody know?
They both sound wonderful.
We've met each other. We've done 11 books, and I've never known which.
They're two different people.
That's right. I've met him a few times. He's a wonderful man. But I wrote a song in the sequel to Take Me Out of the Bathtub. There was about a boy eating a chicken sandwich. And he did a sketch of a boy eating a chicken sandwich. And when the color came back, it was a fish on the sandwich. And they said he felt like drawing a fish. And I said, but it says chicken. And they said, well, can you just change the words? Because it's easier to change the words than to redraw a fish into a chicken. Which I did. So instead of catfish parm, instead of chicken parm, it's catfish parm. And I've gotten letters from kids saying, how do you make catfish parm? It's like, ask him. I don't know. But otherwise, I'm just beholden and blown away by the skills that they bring to a book. They're called picture books because pictures help tell the story.
Oh, yeah. I had it backfire on me once, though, because I talked to the illustrator. So the illustrator, Brendan Kearney, who illustrates the Lady Pancake and Sir French Toast series, book 6 comes out this fall. It's not out at the festival this weekend, but it's called Attack of the Scones. And a teacher that I Zoomed with, I actually shared the sketches with them last spring. She said one of her students asked why I didn't put Obi-Wan Kenobi in the book. And so I thought, oh, I should totally do that. That's a great idea. And it was still in sketch form. So I said, it's going to take too long if I go through my editor. I'm just going to email Brandon. And I emailed him. And I was like, can you do Obi-Wan Kenobi? He already looks like a Kenobi. He's a white guy with a white beard. He's like a brown rapper. And he immediately, the next day, he's in England, so he wrote back the next day. He had the pick. He's like, where should we put it? And I was like, great. So he just slipped it into the next round of sketches. But then 4 months later, the legal department made us take it out because Disney's very litigious. I know. So I couldn't even use it. So it totally backfired. So it's like even the one time I tried to go around the editor, the legal department ended up getting involved. So apparently it's illegal for me to do this. So yeah. Anyway, so if you've seen the sketches of Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're lucky because it's not going to be in the book.
Sure. One of the questions written here, because I have no original thoughts right now, is what kind of stuff did you enjoy reading when you were younger?
I loved reading things that made me cry, and so I really loved a tearjerker. And one that I recently reread was Where the Red Fern Grows,
by Ralston Wills?
I don't know.
Something like that. But I reread it, and it was very funny. And I didn't remember my association with it was sort of sadness over what happens. I don't want to give it away. But it's a very funny book.
I was not a reader when I was a kid. Mm. I hated it. It wasn't until probably high school where I actually got into reading. I was a competitive swimmer, and if anyone knows swimming at all, meets went all day. You were there. You're there in the morning until God knows how late. Depends on when your event shows up. So you have nothing to do. You're just sitting there, and nobody wants to watch swimming, not even swimmers. So a friend of mine hands me a book and says, look, this is right up your alley. You should read it. And so I'm like, ah, come on, it's a book. But nothing to do. So I started reading it, and I fell in love with it. And it's an old fantasy. It's called The Belgariad by David Eddings. And I read that book, and then every single book in that series, and then every other book in that series, and then I started looking for stories, that were recommended by that author and other books, and so sometimes it just takes one. So any of those reluctant readers out there that are listening, it just takes one book. That's all it is.
I'm kind of with Paul. I wasn't a reader either at the beginning. For me, it was film and theater. I was lucky enough to be able, not too far from the city, so my parents would take me to see shows, and I was a real cinephile. I loved the movies, but can I tell you that has helped me so much in terms of my writing, because I can really see the drama and the page turn in stories, like almost like the curtain goes down and the curtain comes up, like what is that moment in the story that's going to make somebody want to continue reading. So So I wasn't a reader till later on, and I discovered, for me, it was this, probably it's going to sound very old-fashioned, but I got into Nancy Drew stories. Mm-hmm. I was into the mystery of all that, mm-hmm. but yeah.
I like the sad stuff, too. Mm. And the deep friendship stuff, the very, like, Judy Bloom, and Frog and Toad series. Oh my gosh, it still makes me want to cry.
Oh, please.
All the feels.
Oh, yeah, and then Don't Ask Alice. Does anybody remember that
book? Yes. Yeah.
That was the thing.
It was the diary.
But
the fake diary.
But it wasn't. It's a true story.
Wait a second.
I thought it was
propaganda.
No. Well, okay. Maybe this is this is news.
We'll talk about this.
There are revelations happening.
I just realized that your audience has no idea who was a reader and who wasn't a reader.
Jackie was not.
So, not a visual medium. It's where I was not a reader either, and I didn't. This is Rich Michelson. I never read a children. I didn't grow up in a house with books. I didn't even know such things as existed as children's books or picture books. And not until I opened my gallery, and a few years in, my first artist was Barry Mosier. And Barry came to me one day and he said, I got an offer to illustrate a children's book. What do you think? And I said, Barry, I think that's the worst X idea I've ever heard in my life. What are you going to start doing, little watercolor bunnies? I mean, you're a serious artist. And that was my impression. And Barry said, well, they offered me a lot of money. I said, then why are you asking me? Do it. And he it turned out that the first book he was offered was The Adventures of Brer Rabbit. So we got watercolor bunnies for our show.
So funny.
And people who showed up were some of Barry's friends, one whose name was Eric Carl, another one whose friend whose name was Jane Yorwin, people I'd never heard of, another person who was teaching school at the time and had not done any books was Jane Dyer, and I, for the first time, saw that, wow, I was writing poetry, and I loved art, and I said, you can put them together in a children's book, and it's amazing. And some of these artists are incredible, as good as what I've seen in museums. And some of the writing are as good as the best poets I'm reading. So, you know, it's like somebody who suddenly I became a convert, and it became the most important thing to me to write children's books, because I didn't have the opportunity to read that as a child. So it was nice. I was much, much older at the point when I read my first children's book.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter, her favorite story is that when she was young and had like six or, you know, some of her friends over for sleepovers when they were six or seven, and I had to read to them at night, I would read to them from what I was reading. I remember once I was reading Kafka's Metamorphosis. The next morning, my wife, who wasn't home that night, said, "What did you do? I'm getting calls from all the other parents. Are you nuts?" And then when my daughter started bringing friends home from college, I would be sitting there reading, you know, like the stupids. So I have progressed opposite, negatively, which I recommend to everyone.
I was a big reader growing up. This is Natasha. I was a really shy kid, and so reading was sort of my way of, you know, kind of exploring my imagination and ultimately, you know, starting to think about stories myself. And I read most of what you guys were talking about. I love the Judy Blume stuff. I love the sad stuff. And I think early on, I started to realize that there was a little bit of a disconnect. I'm African American. All of my books really are based in African American culture and really just bringing a sense of joy. And I hate to use the word universality, but this idea that we can all be connected in certain ways through our specific cultures and identities is something that's really important to me in my work. And I realized as a child growing up that there was always this little bit of a disconnect, that there was always a need to kind of, the life that I was living, and I knew who I was, I knew who my family was, you know, we had a pretty good life, but that wasn't in the books that I was reading. And I think that's one of the things that really started me on that path to kind of bridge that gap between, you know, the Judy Blume stories and then the stories about Black families at that time. Really, I couldn't relate to them because they were all so sad and they were all so traumatic. And I feel that even today, that we still, you know, are kind of based in that view of Black life and Black culture, which is getting better. But early on, I think that's when I started realizing that there was internally, not in my mind, I wasn't saying, we need to write books about, you know, Black families like ours. But it was definitely a feeling that I think stayed with me and inspired me to write in the way that I write now.
I would love to add something if I could. I totally agree with Paul. With reluctant readers, you have to find that book. Once you find that book for a child, they get hooked. And I think that's what's so wonderful about all these books we have on the table. And the book fest, the students can talk to authors and meet authors and illustrators and see them and see that they're real people and hear stories and why you wrote the book that you wrote. And I think that this book fest in itself can really help hook those reluctant readers.
Yeah. And the fact that you do so much fundraising to give every child, what is it called? A good for. It's not attached to a dollar amount. I think it's amazing and really special.
And we spend a lot of time reading the book so that the students are familiar. And we say, this is a book that you could get with your good for coupon. And having authors coming into the school so that they can see them. It's just fantastic.
So is everyone going home and writing a good for book now? Is that what all that chitter chatter?
Yeah, I was a reluctant reader too. And for anyone out there in the audience who is ESL or English as a second language, I didn't enjoy reading because I didn't understand English. I came here when I was 7 years old from Turkey, and so I was a rocky road to reading and learning the language. But then, again, similar to my friends here in middle school. I started reading Judy Blume books, and you know, that's when, you know, I started getting interested. And then there was my middle school English teacher. She was a very grumpy lady, but when she when she started reading a book to us, she just transformed in front of our eyes. She became a different person, and she was so passionate and excited and lively, and she became just this one happy person. And and seeing that made me more interested in reading. And yeah, she's probably passed by now, so she won't hear me say she was grumpy, but but yeah, so teachers are very powerful in the reading journey. And yeah, so for anyone who's out there who's doing ESL, you can write a book. If I can do it, you can do it.
I don't know if we heard from everyone, but I'm going to move on to our probably last question, because we've got about 8 minutes left, I think. What do you appreciate most about writing for young audiences and their parents or guardians or whoever's reading to them? Like, what made you choose to write picture books?
As a nonfiction writer,
what do you love about it?
This is Gabe talking. I'm learning things again, because whenever I meet with kids, I tell them I write about things I want to know more about. And so I have a question about an animal or a question about part of the country, and it helps me learn. And then visiting the classrooms, nothing beats that. I wanted to be a teacher, but I chickened out. And so I like to go into the classroom and have fun with the kids, get great ideas from kids. I told some of the Hudson students yesterday that I was working on a book about death, and these kids had amazing ideas for it. And so I was quickly taking notes.
I do it for the money.
I do it just to be
Josh
in the
room. Josh, be honest. Yeah.
I do it just to get in the same room with Josh Funk. Yeah. Who, by the way, is in my four-letter first name, four-letter last name club.
Nice.
Oh. I'm with Joshua, though, so I don't know if...
I don't call... Well, I didn't even call you Josh, but...
Yeah, four-letter words.
I'd started writing just because I had an idea. That was it. And it just kind of ate at me. And it drove my wife crazy about me saying, hey, that would make a great picture book. You know, that would make a great picture book. And she just finally just said, write it. Stop talking about it and write it. You know, so it just became more of a passion than really any type of, you know, I just find it fun.
Then you went to Disney and stood in line and had to write a book, right?
There you go.
You just
had a whiny kid.
If you remember the Rosie O'Donnell show, which the kids definitely don't, but I used to write the funny songs every day. Wrote like 1,000 parody songs for the show. Oh, wow. And my daughter one night said, and I know it seems like my kids suggest all my books, but this is, my daughter said, how come you write all these funny songs for adults? You know, songs for kids. And that became Take Me Out of the Bathtub. And that was the first of 11 Silly Dilly songs, 9 Silly Dilly song books. And that got me started, and there's nothing I'd rather be doing than reaching out with kids. And
you owe your kids royalties.
I owe my kids royalties. It's
I'm sure those kids have collected on your royalties.
They have. There's, you know, well, my son once said, who gets the money now that Dr. Seuss isn't living? Who gets the money from his books? And I said, well, his family or a foundation or something. And there was a big pause in the back seat, and he said, wait a minute. When you're dead, I get the money from your books? And I said, no, your three siblings do, but not you.
Yeah, I write for adults as well. And, you know, in the scheme of the world, that's considered like a more important, you know, a higher thing. I mean, for most people, you know, there's a... When you... You know, if you're sitting next to someone in an airplane and you say, oh, I write kids' books, then they tell you the 12 kids' books that they want to write, but they didn't have time yesterday. and yet, I find it much more important to write for children and to have good books for children, because, you know, that's what's going to form your entire life. You know, I mean, people remember... you know, the books that they read when they were young, you know, when the first art you see are the things that stay with you forever. So I think it's more important to have good books and good writing and good art for children than it is for adults, even though, you know, I choose to do both. But there's more satisfaction, I think, inside me for writing for children than there is when my other books come out.
I used to be an elementary school teacher for many, many years. And but I loved it so much. But I think what I found is that when I didn't have the words, there were books that would give me those words or those jumping off points. Or there weren't the books, and then it was like, wait, we need more of those books to talk about this or that or the other. And it, you know, it's taken a long time, but it's nice to see more and more stories being told and people being represented. But I think that's what got me started, and I appreciate so much being able to kind of work through my own childhood angst in my books and all the things that I wish that I had someone tell me or talk to me about, and to sort of push back against what we're seeing with adults who forget how to communicate with each other with kindness. They forget kids are watching. Maybe they don't care. And so we have this opportunity to put that out there. Mm-hmm. And then I get to go back and visit kids and educators who are, like, seriously my people. So, yeah, so that's the best.
And do yoga with a room full of first graders.
With first graders, yes.
Did they do the lion's one?
And the lions, did. We did lion's they breath. Did.
I've always had trouble with that one, because especially if you're in a yoga studio with a mirror, like, having to see yourself or your friends doing that. I don't know if you know.
No mirrors.
It involves sticking your tongue out and, like, making a loud lion noise. Hard not to laugh.
If there are any educators listening in the audience, I started writing because of a preschool teacher. And she did just one simple thing. She invited me to her classroom to read about our holiday, about Eid al-Adha. And at the time, my son was 4 years old. And I said, yes, I'd love to come. I'd love to read. But then I couldn't find any books about this particular holiday. And we only have two major holidays. So I was like, how do we not have any books? We only have two holidays. There are close to 2 billion Muslims in the world. And so that one invitation got me researching and looking at what are the gaps are there in the marketplace that we need to fill. And up until that point, I grew up here in America, but up until that point, I didn't realize there was space for me, like my culture, my holidays, in my faith. I didn't know there was a need. I just thought, well, these are the books, and they don't need me, and I don't belong, and I don't fit in, and I'm not part of, I exist, but I'm not represented. So I guess it's not needed. That's why it's not out there. But then with that one invitation from the teacher, she said, we need books like this, and we study different holidays every year, and so you should get that published. But it never occurred to me that there was that space, there was that need. And so when she gave me that invitation, I started researching. And the new book, shameless plug, I dedicated my new book to this particular teacher, Mrs. V, at my son's preschool teacher, my son is no longer in preschool. It took me 10 whole years to get this book out. And my son is now 14 years old. At the time, he was 4. So, but I'm grateful that it's out there. But yeah, to any educators listening out there, you're powerful, you're amazing, and please invite your community members into your classrooms and say, hey, would you like to read about your culture or about your holidays? And we'd love to learn more. And maybe you'll create more authors and illustrators.
Well, for me, it's been evolutionary. So I started out, I mentioned that I was a cinephile, and I saw this image. My first book was The Green Umbrella. And I saw this image, an illustration, just somebody's, with this little lonely elephant holding a green umbrella, just this white background. And I wondered, where is he going? Who is he waiting for? I mean, why is he standing out in the rain? And so that became The Green Umbrella. But as, I don't know if everybody remembers the beginnings of We Need Diverse Books, hashtag We Need Diverse Books, I was at Jacob Javits, the book expo, and I remember that big push, and I started to think about myself as a Latina woman wanting to say, well, hey, yeah, I think I have something to say, and I hope others want to hear it. So I started to delve more into, similar to you, into my background, my culture, my history. And I'm so happy, like yourself, to see that editors and publishers today are excited mm-hmm. to share all these diverse stories. And, again, creating community, creating connections, network, because today, children, with all the noise going on, and they uniquely see and understand, they're studying climate change, they hear about the wars, and they need to be seen and heard. And sometimes I wonder if they feel seen and heard with all the noise going on. So, and this can be done in so many ways, because humorous books like Josh and Paul write, you know, kids mm-hmm. are still kids and they need to laugh. So being seen and heard can also mean that, you know, I just need a funny story, you know, and need to laugh. So all these, you know, all these ideas just came to me, as it evolved, rather, as a writer.
Thank you so much all for joining us today for our radio broadcast for the Hudson Children's Book Festival. We're so excited to see everyone tomorrow and to have everyone celebrating your work. So thank you so much for sharing with us.
I have one more plug to put in. We brought to my kids' school in Germantown two mm-hmm. authors that'll be at the festival tomorrow. And it's such a great way to capitalize on these people being in from out of town. Mm-hmm. You get to save a little bit of money on the travel expense. So I highly recommend anyone who's connected to a school, whether you're an educator or a parent, talk to your PTSA about bringing in these authors, because it's a great opportunity mm-hmm. and they have so much fun.
Yeah, I still remember all the author visits from when I was a kid, and it was just so exciting. It was like a celebrity visit.
We also have free transportation, which yes. I don't know if you've discussed.
Yeah, so there's trolley stops throughout. It's at least through Hudson, I think, Greenport
there's
and Stockport,
sign. Yes,
maybe?
And there's a sign, and they run mm-hmm. all day long.
Yeah, and there's a map on the Hudson Children's Book Festival website, hudsonchildrensbookfestival.com, so you can see where all those trolley stops are. One is right out in front of the Hudson Area Library. Mm-hmm. So.
Front of the schools.
And it's supposed to be a beautiful day, so you could also take a walk. I think this last time I checked the weather, it was supposed to be a beautiful day. So fingers crossed.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Hope you enjoy your time in Hudson. And yeah, have a great book fest.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think we're all cool. Yeah. Yeah. I was going to ask.